create two tier systems.
I may have all this stuff when I was here. There'd be one line. My mom was actually working.
Meeting will come to order, and this is the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee. And we have one bill that we'll be hearing today, and then this is an energy bill. And then the rest of the meeting will be devoted to telecommunications issues. And we'll have an overview of broadband. I realize that we've never really given this committee a basic 101 on connectivity, and so I thought it would be important for you to hear, you know, the various terms and what they mean and how they relate and perhaps how they interact. I'm not even sure about that. But Rick King is going to be here to help us with that. And then we will get a report on the broadband mapping project. So we have before us at this time Senate File 249, and Senator Kevin Dahl is introducing it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm here today to introduce Senate File 249, and I have a couple of gentlemen here that's been working on a project that would, in cooperation with school districts and wind energy, a project that they've been working on for, I think, 3 years now, a cooperative of 14 schools. And this is a project that has had many ups and downs, and they're going to talk a little bit about the history of where this bill has been. We've come so close to getting this through, and we're here again asking for consideration to kind of put the final get the final lap done on this issue. So I will I believe start with Superintendent Dr. Chris Richardson, actually my boss when I'm not here, from Northfield School District, and he'll be followed by Ted Suss from the Wabasso School District. So go ahead.
Thank you, Kevin.
Mr. Richardson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Dr. Chris Richardson. I'm superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools. I'm also vice chair of the Minnesota Schools Wind Energy Cooperative, MISWEC. The cooperative includes basically 14 districts from across the state. We include some fairly large districts like Elk River, some other very small districts like Truman, and then districts in between in terms of size like Northfield and Hastings. And we're a group that has come together looking at the concept of sharing and collaborating over the development of a wind farm. We're planning to locate that wind farm in southern Minnesota, and we would like to urge your consideration of the passage of Senate File 249. Basically, as Senator Dahl indicated, we've been involved in this effort for nearly 3 years. We've learned a lot about patience as part of working through the effort to try to make our wind project a reality. We chose to become involved because our community has a very strong energy conservation ethic that's previously resulted in two wind turbines being placed in Northfield, one by the Carleton College campus and one on the St. Olaf campus. And I think our board felt that as a school district, we needed to model the same kind of ethic, but we were also acutely aware of our limitations as a school district to fund such a project on our own. As a result, we looked for other partners and basically identified 13 other school districts who were willing to work with us along with Johnson Controls look at coming together to collaborate on a project using federal clean renewable energy bonds, or CREB bonds. And we had planned initially to use those as the source of financing for the purchase of the turbines and the construction of the wind farm. And as a group of 14 districts, we submitted to the federal government the application for CREB bonds, and each of our districts did receive authorization for up to $3 million in CREB bonds. We also aggressively began the process of working on putting together the other pieces that need to be in place. And as I'm sure some of you are aware, that includes garnering a Midwest Independent System Operator Permit, or MISO, and also looking at a power purchase agreement or power purchase piece that we would need to have with a current energy provider, Xcel, Great River, some other energy provider. We also moved a lease option property in that had favorable wind characteristics and also to complete the wind data studies that we needed to do in order to see if that land would be most appropriate. Over the last 2 years, we've learned that while a MISO permit is something we thought could be achieved fairly easily, we found out that even though we'd gotten our MISO permit in the queue and were originally told that by mid-2008 we would have one, we're now being told that more likely it might be mid-2010 before we receive approval. We also learned as we had initial contacts and conversations with energy companies that really without the MISO permit, the ability to negotiate a power purchase agreement with any utility company was fairly limited. Most importantly, to our request for your consideration of Senate File 249, we determined that while our districts could issue CREB bonds, that the nature of CREB bonds indicated that once you sold the bonds, that you needed to start making payments back on the principal of those bonds in the same year they were sold. And so 1/16th of the principal needs to be paid back each year. Well, given the timing for the MISO, given the timing in terms of once you even requested the possibility of purchasing turbines and so on, could lead you to being 3 years out before you could actually implement, we were looking at the concept of having to pay out 3/16ths of the cost of the turbines and construction before any of the school districts realized one penny of revenue from this process. As school districts, we felt that that put us in a negative situation and made it really not possible for us to make use of CREB bonds. At that point, we looked for an alternative. And basically, the alternative we identified was an equity investor financing strategy by creating a limited liability company, or LLC. We know that this approach has been used successfully by a number of cooperatives and groups of farmers in southern Minnesota to allow equity investors and cooperatives to have joint ownership in wind energy projects. So before we proceeded, we thought, however, we better check with the Attorney General and make sure that we were legally able to enter into or create an LLC. Well, without commenting on the wisdom of such action, the AG determined that Minnesota schools do not currently possess the statutory authority for LLC ownership. We then went to the legislature, as Senator Dahl indicated, to request action to grant LLC joint ownership for the sole purpose of jointly owning a wind farm pursuant to Minnesota Statute 123B. It was included in both the House and Senate omnibus education bill last year, but was vetoed by the governor in the end of the session. But as far as we know, there was no objection from either House nor from the governor's office. So we would very much like to continue with this important wind project. We think it makes a great deal of sense. It does reflect what we're hearing from communities across the state about looking at strategies for collaboration and sharing. It also focuses very directly in terms of our desire to model stewardship and to model green energy production. But to do that, the passage of Senate File 249 is what we need in order to create that limited liability company that would allow us the financing to fund this project. Thank you.
Dr. Richardson,
yes.
How much energy are you planning on generating?
Ted, could you help us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as currently planned,
just give us your name for the record,
yes,
Ted Suss, Superintendent of Schools, Wabasso Public Schools, and Chair of the Minnesota Schools Wind Energy Cooperative. I've never been able to make the acronym work.
Okay, and Mr. Suss, were you going to do a presentation too?
Yes.
Okay, why don't I'll leave my questions until you're finished then. So if you'd like to go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'll start with answering the question. Our project, as it's currently designed, would produce 86 million kilowatts of electricity in a year. It'd be 25 megawatts of power.
How much?
86 million kilowatts per year.
What is that in megawatts?
No, that would be, somebody can do the math quickly. It's a 25 megawatt project in terms of the generating capacity. 10 2.5 megawatt towers.
10?
10 2.5 megawatt towers.
That your bill asked for 3.3, not to exceed 3.3 megawatts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, under Minnesota law at present time, school districts have the authority to own, operate, and there's a bunch of other verbs there, 3.3 megawatts of generating capacity. That's current law.
Per district.
And we are asking to amend that law only to the extent of the manner in which the school districts would own the project. We're not talking about changing in any way our authority to own or how much we would own, just how we would own it.
Go ahead with your presentation.
Sure. Okay. As I said, my name is Ted Suss, Superintendent of Schools in Wabasso, Minnesota. The last federal energy bill that was passed created clean renewable energy bonds, CREBS. And the philosophy behind that was that prior to that, private investors building a wind farm could claim and receive a 2 cent per kilowatt hour production tax credit for the first 10 years, and then, of course, they could depreciate the project. Those tax incentives made it feasible to build wind projects. A not-for-profit organization, such as a farmers cooperative or an electric cooperative, or a government entity, such as school districts, of course, has no income that can be offset with those tax credits. The Congress felt that in order to make it possible for government units to participate in alternative energy projects, created the Krebs bonds mechanism. In order to sell the Krebs bonds, a school district or someone else had to apply to the IRS, specify a project, and receive authority. Through the work of Johnson Controls as sort of a facilitator, 14 districts, Northfield being one, Wabasso being one, and I have the list here of the 14 districts. I usually can do it by heart, but I'll read them. Brainerd, Chisago Lakes, Edgerton, Elk River, Faribault, Hastings, New Prague, Northfield, St. Peter, Truman, Wabasso, Watertown Mayor, Winona, and Zumbrota, Mazeppa. Each of the 14 districts received authorization from the IRS to sell $3 million worth of Krebs bonds, total of $42 million. As Dr. Richardson did an excellent job of explaining, we soon found that the Krebs bonds just simply don't work for a project like this. We received our award in about June, and the deadline for actually selling the bonds was December 31st of that year. It was subsequently extended for 6 months and for another 6 months, but we applied for our MISO permit. We were at a meeting in June when we told that we had gotten our SPIN number or Q number or whatever it was and that we would have our permit by the end of that year. We're now coming up on the second anniversary of that meeting, and we're now told that we're looking for a year to 2 years. So obviously the deadline for selling the bonds has long since passed. Dr. Richardson did an excellent job of explaining some of the other problems with the payback schedule, and there was a problem with the value of the tax credit that the bond purchaser would get. The commissioner of the IRS was to certify the bonds on their day of sale at a tax credit amount. So I give $42 million to buy these bonds. I'm not going to get any interest, but I'm going to get this tax credit. The commissioner pegged that to a type of bond that's less risky than these bonds. And so the investor looking at it is going to say, why would I invest here to get a tax credit that's worth six when I can invest here and get seven? So the Krebs bonds just simply won't work. We then embarked on looking for other methods of finance, and we started looking at this equity shift model that's being used by several groups of farmers in Minnesota, some cooperatives around the country. And the way that works is a limited liability corporate or limited liability company is established. The ownership of that company is 99% in the hands of the equity investor for 10 years, during which time the tax credits are obtained and used. And after 10 years, the equity shifts to the partner. In this case, it would be the school districts. And there's a whole set of IRS regulations that govern this shift. We proceeded down that path, actually had an attorney's opinion that school district authority did allow school districts to be a partner in a limited liability company. But our own attorney for our cooperative advised us that while there was nothing saying we didn't have the authority, in Minnesota, school districts have the authority that's specified in law. This wasn't specified in law. Therefore, if we wanted to proceed with this financing mechanism, we needed to have the legislature add to our list of legal authorities as school boards, school districts, the ability to be a partner in an LLC. And that's all we're asking in the bill, is to have the authority of the school districts amended to permit being a partner in a limited liability company. We're not asking to increase the authority of school boards to have more generating capacity, to have any expansion of authority on what we do with the electricity. It's merely asking for another mechanism to finance the project. I have some other testimony, but Dr. Richardson did such a good job of covering things that I'm going to dispense with that and save your time. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I have quite a few. First of all, it's 14 districts, did
14
you say?
14 districts.
And they're non-contiguous.
They're scattered all over the state.
Okay. And so these school districts together will be one partner with a group of other partners in a 25-megawatt wind farm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 14 school districts 2 years ago in January, or was it three?
Three.
Formed a joint powers agreement under Minnesota law, the same mechanism that we use to form, you know, various education districts. So we now are a legal entity under Minnesota law. And that cooperative will be one of the partners in, as I understand it, a two-partner limited liability company.
So the other...
That would assume there's one investor who will be the other partner.
So, Mr. Suss, the school districts together will own 3.3 megawatts, and the partner will own the other 21?
The total... Each school district is currently authorized to own 3.3 megawatts of generating capacity. I think that's 52.6. It's been a while since I did that math. So as a group, the school districts currently have the authority to own, operate, and all those other verbs in that section of statute, 3.3 megawatts of capacity times 14. The project will be much smaller than our total legal authority.
Madam Chair.
Okay, and your purpose in the wind project, is it revenue generation or low-cost energy for the district? Or what?
I would say that every one of the 14 districts has its own purpose. Dr. Richardson talked about the energy consciousness of his community and how important it is that they do that. Some of the districts perhaps are just in it for the money. I think all of us are interested in the educational value of demonstrating to our students and our communities the advantages of renewable energy. I know in my case personally, in our school district's case, we are very conscious of our responsibility, which we think everyone shares, to do our part to reduce our carbon footprint, to use the terminology that I don't think I'd heard when we started this project. But there are a variety of reasons. One of the requirements in the law currently on the books is that there be an education component. My dream is that someday we would have an environmental learning center based at our wind farm. I don't know if that'll ever happen. But we do have a curriculum that's been developed around alternative energy that some of the districts are currently using and others are considering using it, but a variety of reasons.
Do you have an understanding about whether your involvement in this project will affect your education aid?
I would not expect that it would expect the impact education aid any more than if a school district owns some farmland and they get rent from that farm.
Okay. Senator Dibble? It's Senator Dahl?
Senator Dahl was before
okay.
me.
A couple of questions for you, either one of you, I guess. First, I guess I'll start off with the education component part of it, is that if this wind farm is going to be in one location and these schools are spread out across the state, is that going to do field trips, or how do you combine that education component, just knowing that you purchase power from wind, that makes a difference? I guess I'm not finding the connection, how you're going to actually utilize having a wind farm as a educational component.
Senator and members of the committee.
Back to Richardson.
Thank you. Basically, the thrust in terms of the educational component is that mounted on the generators themselves will be sensing equipment, which will allow students remotely from computers at each of the school districts to gather and look at data around energy production, wind speed, all the other pieces that are part of that particular process. I think as Superintendent Suss indicated, I think there would also be several of us that at various times might even take a look at the concept of field trips actually to the wind farm for students to see it. But I think we have the ability to actually remotely look at a lot of the data and use that data in science classes and other classes to talk about energy production and the impact that can have with a farm of this size without having to be right next to it.
Okay, thank you. And Madam
Senator
Chair,
Dahl.
Follow up on this one, then I have one other question. Is that something, though, that equipment that you're talking about there, is that something you're working with Johnson Controls on, or is that is that equipment you'll currently own, or you're going to
be a separate package? Actually, that equipment needs to be installed on each of the generators anyway for the company that would monitor the operation of the system to be able to check to make sure everything is running correctly and is a peak optimum operation. So it's just a matter of getting the URL that allows us to link into that set of
okay. Thank you. And Madam Chair, one last question is just for clarification on the limited liability corporation or partnership. It says it's established for the sole purpose of this project. Does that mean that this is the only time that you've ever had a limited liability corporation within the school districts, or do you have other models, other reasons that you would have limited liability corporations or partnerships?
Mr. Sess.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, under current law, I don't believe any Minnesota school district is allowed to be a partner in a limited liability company, and so I would say there are no models of school districts in Minnesota being partners in limited liability companies. There are a variety of private enterprise school district partnerships across the state. I'm thinking of a neighboring district in my area where a local company has built a fitness center in school district space, runs a for-profit commercial fitness center. The school district is able to use it for physical education. That's not done under a limited liability company, but there are many, many examples across the state where business and schools are participating in joint ventures.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, my question has been asked.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
That was a similar question, too, although I wonder if the language
does the language, is your understanding of the language that being a limited partner in a partnership, limited liability company, or a shareholder in a corporation, that you're really seeking to be a limited partner? I mean, your project is describing a limited partner, being a limited partner as an organization, correct?
Madam Chair, we're getting into areas that aren't my expertise, but a limited liability company is a specific legal entity in Minnesota, I've learned, and that is the mechanism that we wish to use, and the people who own an LLC are referred to in the statute as partner, mm-hmm. not owners. And so the terminology tracks the LLC law more than any desire on our part to be a partner versus an owner.
Then may I follow up? On the second page, you're describing that you cannot sell, transmit, or distribute the energy at retail or provide for end use of the electric energy at an off-site facility. What's that attempting to address?
Madam Chair, I believe that's an amendment that someone wishes to offer to the bill. And I could certainly comment on it at the time it comes before the committee.
I'll wait till it becomes an amendment. Thank you very much.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mentor, is this going to be heard by the Education Committee?
I'm sorry, Senator.
Is this going to be heard by the Education Committee?
It is going to be heard by the Education Committee.
Okay. So all my questions are, like, probably more geared. I don't serve on that committee, but they're more education-oriented. I'm just trying to kind of get my head around, Madam Chair, a school becoming part of an LLC. You know, schools going into business and as worthwhile as wind, you know, generation is. And I, you know, I appreciate the creativity, and clearly this seems to be a response to, you know, needed resources in our schools for their education mission. You know, I just wondered what, you know, school is going to start opening restaurants and, you know,
Chair,
things like that.
Senator,
so,
there are a couple of restaurants in the state run by schools.
Well,
one in my district.
Yeah.
That's
Madam Chair.
That's interesting. Now, did I hear that this was in last year's bill?
Was it in last year's bill?
This language passed the legislature last year as part of the omnibus education bill that was vetoed.
Did it come through the Energy Committee or just?
I don't
off
recall that it did hit our committee last year. Did it?
Didn't need to.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I remember this subject coming up in the media and we are having some discussion, Senator Stumpf expressing some opinions about this offsetting the school aid. But I just heard that it doesn't offset the school aid, so I'm not clear.
Yeah,
why am I confused on that?
Senator Dibble, I believe we had a conversation on the House floor, or on the Senate floor, actually, mm-hmm. about this. That was my concern, and asked that it be referred to the Senate Education Finance Division. Mm-hmm. But then I think, did this come up in the conference committee that this amendment was added? Is that how it happened?
I believe it was placed on the bill in conference committee on the Senate side.
Right.
Passed the House on the floor is my recollection. But if I could address that issue if you wish.
Mr. Suss.
There is another provision in law that, and I'm not real familiar with this because it doesn't affect my school district, that places a tax on wind generating projects. It's a kind of a state collected real estate tax, if you will. That money is paid directly to the school district in which the towers are located. I believe the county gets some, perhaps the city, I'm not sure. Because that is a state mandated and state collected tax, the legislature 2-3 years ago determined that there would be a reduction or an offset of state aid to those school districts equal to the amount of state generated, state collected tax that was then sent to the school district. This is a venture of the school district, no different from many other commercial revenue-generating ventures engaged in by school districts across the state. And as such, I believe, and I think the folks who looked at it last year believed, the legal counsel, is a totally different matter. The state is not, you know, giving us, they're not collecting money and then giving it to a set group of districts.
Dr. Richardson, did you have something
you
wanted to
add? Yes, Madam
Chair,
if I could, and again responding to Senator Dibble. I would frame that in Northfield, and I think we've made a public statement to this effect several times at the cooperative, and that was if we made not one penny from this project, we would be happy. And that's probably a little different, as Superintendent Suss indicated, from some of the other districts. But our sense is we already have two turbines in our community. We actually originally had tried to partner with Carleton when they were first putting their turbine up, again, because we felt it was the right thing to do. It was the modeling that kind of green behavior that we thought was appropriate. At the time, that was when they determined that it was not legal for school districts to put up wind turbines. And I believe at that time, actually, I think Ray Cox, representative from Northfield at the time, basically brought a bill that was passed that then allowed school districts to actually put up wind turbines. So I think our focus, and again, maybe slightly different than from where other folks are coming, but our sense is we want to do this because we think it's the right thing to do. Our community expects it from us, and my board has been very strong and adamant in its desire to create some kind of wind energy projects that would allow us to give back to that carbon footprint that we're trying to create, or that lower carbon footprint we're trying to create. Thank you.
So I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but what is the school district's investment in the project?
You want to?
Mr. Suss?
Under the limited liability company mechanism, the school districts would invest 1% of the total project collectively, and at this point, the plan is that would be financed. The actual out-of-pocket from the school district would range from anywhere from about $9,000 to about $20,000. And that depends on how much of the project is financed with a direct investment by an investor and how much of it is financed by a loan that would be taken out jointly between the investor and the school districts. It would be a non-recourse financing if there was a loan, meaning there would be, you know, no pledge of the faith and credit of the school district. But most of our conversations have been through an investment banker, so we aren't talking to the actual investor. The investor would put up 100% of the money. There would be no financing. Or he would have put up 99%, and we would put up 1%. And so that's why that range is anywhere from about $9,000 to about $20,000.
Do you have an identified partner? Is it one partner?
Again, those of you who work in corporate America with finance, everything you do is preceded by a confidentiality agreement. And I haven't even been asked to sign one, but the investment banking firm in New York that's working with Johnson Controls on our behalf apparently has identified investors, and each investor would be a single sole investor. There wouldn't be multiple partners.
So how does your involvement then affect the tax status of this wind farm?
If we own 1%, by we now I mean the cooperative, and the investor owns 99%, we would get 1% of the production tax credit, which has no value, and we would get 1% of the depreciation, which to us has no value. The investor would receive 99% of the production tax credit and 99% of the depreciation.
It's a pretty good deal for your partner.
Well, but they're putting up 50-some million dollars. The projections that we're seeing give the investor a slightly better return than if they were to buy the Krebs bonds.
Are you considered a seabed project?
This would be a seabed project. And part of the reason that an investor would even be talking to us, because they can build the project without us, is the advantages of a seabed project.
And then you can sell the energy tax-free?
I'm not all that familiar with the seabed aspects of it, Madam Chair.
Oh, no, that's what your bill asks for, though, isn't it?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. We are, see, again, I think you're dealing with that amendment.
No, this is before the amendment. It says that a tax imposed under this section does not apply to electricity produced by wind energy conversion systems owned or jointly owned by a school board under this section.
Okay. We weren't going to do that. That, I believe, is the tax that I was referring to previously. That is that not the tax? Okay. That part I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
Perhaps council can advise us on that.
Want advice?
Madam Chair, I think the tax that they were talking about was a federal credit, and they're amending a state production tax that I'm not familiar with, but I believe it's the tax that the state collects or the local units of government might collect from in lieu of property taxes, and they're exempting it. So if they owned any smidgen of this property, all the sales would be tax exempt from that tax, and so that would be a tax, state tax advantaged property in competition with other projects.
Madam Chair, that came up last year, and in the discussions I had with the House author, and it must have been someone in the revisor's office last year, I know my personal response was that I thought this project should be treated the same as every other project in the state. And if we weren't part of the picture, taxes would be paid.
Mm-hmm.
That it would be appropriate for this project to pay those same taxes. Now, that's just my personal opinion.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Dahl, for bringing this forward, and I'm honored to be on this bill, and I think I'm sensing there's a little bit of discomfort, or you're not quite sure how this is going to work, but if you look at the big picture, this is exactly the direction that we should be going with our renewable energy thought pattern, asking different school districts to think creatively out of the box. This is the perfect joint sharing services that you can get. You know, this is exactly the area that we should be going in. And so perhaps it needs a little reworking, and I'm not sure, Senator Dahl, if you would like me to move the A1 amendment for you. But I just hope all the members, you know, really think that this is a possibility that gives some great options to school districts out there on all fronts. And also, we are tremendously moving forward in wind energy creativity, and this is just another area. So, keep your thoughts open on this.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you. Appreciate those comments. I agree, but I'm when you asked the question about seabed, that kind of pricked up my ears a little bit. Maybe I've lost touch, or maybe seabed has changed. You know, but I was surprised that the proportions can be so disparate, the 1% with the 99% of the dollars coming in from
I thought that seabed required 51% ownership by the landowner, so that's why I was wondering why it would qualify as seabed.
Yes, yeah, so Madam Chair, I think in any case it would fly in the face from what I understand, at least what the original spirit and intent for seabed was. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think this may be a great idea, you know, and I'm liking most of it. I have some questions about other parts of it, but, you know, if it's coming in and it's doing a take on seabed, that raises some other questions.
Okay. Mr. Suss?
Well, Madam Chair, I want to stress that the authority of school districts to do this is in current law. But what we're asking for is approval of a different ownership model. And I am not an expert on seabed. What we've been told as far as the seabed is that authorizes or mandates the energy companies to front-load the power purchase agreement to make the cash flow work for the project. I'm not familiar with the tax implications of seabed, and I repeat what I said before and what I said last year, and as I was thinking while Senator Rosen was speaking, I was talking with someone from the revisor's office and clearly do not believe that this project should have a tax exemption status that it would have if Dr. Richardson and I were millionaires and we decided to build a project on our own. And from that perspective, I personally wouldn't, if I were in your shoes, support the language for the tax exemption. But as far as the seabed thing, I'm not familiar with all the ramifications of that, other than we've been told that it would be a seabed project.
And where did you get that direction? That it was a seabed project.
From the Johnson Controls folks, as they were advising us about the mechanics of using the equity investor.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think maybe I can get a little more comfortable. I just noticed this this paragraph in the letter, and maybe I missed it in your testimony. Is it your intent to own the entire project after some period of time?
Madam Chair and Senator, the IRS rules under which we would be operating are very precise as to how this ownership transfer can occur. There's some minimum time frames, there's some maximum time frames, there's some minimum percentages, some maximum percentages. After 10 years, the ownership will shift to 80-20 school district private investor, and there's a little range there in the IRS rules. At that point, the school districts, again, under IRS rules, must buy the remaining equity. But the intent is, when this is complete, school districts will fully own it. And I believe that's what makes the seabed work, is that the seabed requires that ultimately a qualifying partner, I believe is the term that's in the seabed statute, has to be a Minnesota school district, or, I mean, a not-for-profit or something. I'm not sure. That's not my area.
And by complete, you're talking about like a 10-year period or a 20-year period?
Within 20 years. No less than 10, no more than 20. Complete ownership will shift to the school district. And that will all be spelled out in the limited liability company agreement.
Okay. I would like to ask if there's anybody in the audience who would like to speak for or against this bill.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Mr. Sundberg. Senator Dahl, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, there is some discussion about removing Section B of Subdivision 7 would be amenable to that.
Well, could we hear from the testifiers first, and then we'll talk about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Obviously, we're not weighing in on the educational aspect direction of the bill, but on the what it's proposing potentially to do as it relates to exclusive service territories. Obviously, co-ops are very jealous of what the service territory law says, because we have an obligation to serve reliable service at reasonable rates. And any time that this could come into question, or we're not sure what approach is being made with a new or different projects like this, we have in the last few years inserted some language very much like, if not exactly like, what you're seeing in the amendment to protect the service territory law so that our customers don't get nibbled away at it. Now, we're not certain that the intent of the bill is to do anything like that, so I'm sure we can find some language, work some language, if this is doesn't work for them, but this is our best that we could come up with at this point. And with the amendment, I think, that I saw last, this would remove some of the objection that we would have to the bill from the service territory perspective.
So, Mr. Sundberg, this is this amendment language, which does everybody have this amendment in front of you? It hasn't been offered yet.
The A1.
The A1 amendment. This is something that you brought forward to the author?
I'm not sure I have. I have an A1, yes, an A1 amendment, but we were talking about possibly the need for some additional clarification to A1.
Okay. Senator Dahl, do you think we could lay this over until Tuesday and you could perhaps meet with the different parties and see if you could come up with some agreement on some language?
Madam Chair, I believe we can work on that. I know I may lose my testifiers, but if, you know, if that's the only sticking point to this particular bill, and if the energy companies are, and Dr. Richardson and Mr. Suss are in agreement with the language that we come up with, I would hope there'd be some assurance that we could move forward with the bill then on Tuesday.
I would think that if you can work out the details of this amendment, that.
And if that, Madam Chair, if that's the only sticking point, and if the committee feels comfortable with moving forward with the bill, save that point, I think we are comfortable with going forward.
And also, for your knowledge, this will go to education, finance, and we'll also have to stop in taxes. Okay.
Would you, Madam Chair, would you, should we move to lay over, or do you want to move the amendment?
I don't think the electric company is willing to agree to the amendment at this point.
Okay, I thought that was their amendment.
Mr. Evans, would you like to come and testify, please?
Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I draft the amendment or worked with members on the amendment. Our concern, as Mr. Sundberg said, is only that, you know, if the school districts want to get into the wind business, that's great. They want to erect a wind project and sell energy to a utility. That's fine. We'll deal with them like we deal with all the other wind developers that are out there. But we want to make sure that it's clear in the legislation that they have two uses for the electricity. One is to use it on site where the electricity is being generated on that property, which is currently allowed, or selling it to an electric utility. And that's what this amendment accomplishes. And if that were made clear in the bill, we wouldn't have any objection to it.
Okay. There is some concern that it limits the authority of some school districts and that the language is written too broadly. And so I think that this needs to be laid over. And we also need to clarify whether this is a seabed project, because it doesn't seem to meet the language defined in the statute. And we'd also like to understand that you'll be under the 25 megawatts. Or that you have the authority to aggregate it. Okay. Okay. So we'll lay this bill over.
Could I make a comment, Senator?
Mr. Suskin.
Only because I have a school district to run,
Mr.
So I can't come back on Tuesday.
Sus,
whatever, close enough. My concern with this amendment is that the school districts now have authority to do something, and this amendment reduces that authority. Now, it may not have a practical effect because of other laws, but although it doesn't affect our project, I certainly would not want to see this committee amend the school district's existing authority to do something. I think that would more properly be the Education Committee, although right. You certainly can advise them.
Although this also affects energy policy, so we have some interest in your working out some language beforehand. Okay. And otherwise, we'd be pulling you back to our committee again.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your
okay.
hearings.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Education.
Thank you. Okay. We'll move on then to our broadband overview and invite Rick King to the table. I urge you not to leave. This is really important information.
Yes. My whole life is this.
Mr. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Rick King. I am the chair of the state's Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force, and I am the Executive Vice President and Chief Operations Officer at Thomson Reuters in Eagan. So I'm pleased to be here to talk to you a little bit about broadband. And I'm going to get up and walk around a little bit if that's okay, but it will be best the way I look
at
this.
As long as you have a microphone.
I'll find one.
Okay.
I think I can grab this out of the stand. Probably everybody has a pretty good idea about what broadband is, but there's probably a few gaps in understanding, and I know I have some in mind. What we tried to do here is distill the essence of this down to a few slides and a few diagrams to fill in some of the gaps for all of you. It's not highly technical, but there's enough technology in it to keep you from being bothered at a cocktail party. So you should know enough to be able to chase people away. These are the ways we're going to cover the material. Just quickly, there's a few slides in each section, and certainly I can stop and cover any questions that you might have. It might be, Madam Chair, depending on whether you want to hold those or whether you want to have people ask them while they have on their mind, I'll leave that up to you. Makes no difference to me at all. It more interactive is even better.
Okay.
I'm going to spend a little time on the way different entities access the internet, and just to give the idea that we want to look at either home users or home businesses, small businesses, and large. And this, again, is distilled down quite a bit. Our company is a large company, so when you look over here, actually put up that we have four lines that are 600 megabits each for a total of 2.5 gigabits, and I'll get to what those things mean in a moment. So large companies basically buy what they need. Providers, multiple providers provide that. We have four different providers that provide us services that ultimately go through Minneapolis or go on a southern route. Everything that goes to Minneapolis goes through Chicago, more or less. And we also go through Kansas City, so we have redundancy. So when you can pay for what your access is, it's sort of unlimited for you. But those lines are for our use. That's not the way the other end of the spectrum works. The other end of the spectrum in the house, you go through a point of presence or a POP, and that would take you to a network access point, in this case Minneapolis, and then off to the internet. And there's different kinds of lines that take you through here in terms of technology. So you've got phone lines, DSL, cable, generally not fiber from the homes or small business to the POP. Then from the POP to the network access point, you have higher speed lines. So you have a bunch of POPs going out there. And these lines are more apt to be fiber and carry more bandwidth. Smaller businesses may be able to go through their POP through what's called T1s. There's T1s or T3s, and those have to do with capacity carried over the lines. They could be copper, they could be fiber. They would more or less buy, they would be on the edge of buying what they need or taking what they have, which would be in one of these two worlds. And then it all feeds up to the internet where things are on these lines between the NAPs and the internet itself, they're very high speed lines. So that's kind of the underlying technology. What's the internet? Bunch of connected computers. So any computer that connects to the internet is part of the internet, and many of them are connected from all over the world. ISP is an internet service provider. That was on the previous slide. And then communication companies have their own backbones that provide point of presence, the way to get in for their consumers, and then access points that connect them to the actual internet itself. Backbones are the piece that the internet big providers have. They're usually multiple fiber optic cables. And cable, copper cable, and fiber optic cable are both taking and digitizing things from whatever the sending is to the receiving area. So basically the speed on each one of them, they're both sending electrical pulses across those lines. But the backbones can carry typically 2.5 or so gigabits. So again, I'm going to come back to the definition of those, but BPS, bits per second, is what that part of the acronym means. And giga is the prefix, and I'll show you the different prefixes, and it even applies to what you just asked earlier with the energy. Megawatts, gigawatts, kilowatts, same preface there. So you'll hear BPS or bits per second. You'll also hear bytes, your home computer, megabytes. Well, there are 8 bits in a byte. So there's just a simple math. Why is it powers of 8? It has to do with powers of 16 and hexadecimal, and that's what the early computer people thought was cool. Why use base 10? Okay, I think I've covered most of this. So broadband defined, it's the ability to connect to the internet in some kind of fashion. Used to be until June, the FCC said broadband is 200 kilobits or more. Now, 200 kilobits was fast when a 56 kilobit dial-up line was really great for you at home. But in June of 2008, 200 kilobits was silly as a definition. Now the definition the FCC put forward is 768 kilobits. Many people would consider that not very high-speed broadband, and only the FCC probably considers that broadband. 50 megabits is roughly the fastest speed that consumers can buy routinely in the state here. And I think providers that provide 50 or 20, or many of them can provide more than 50. But they have the infrastructure to do that. They just don't have the demand, or the cost structure is such that the home buyer won't pay that much. So they're juggling their infrastructure, which can deliver more, perhaps, to certain areas of the state, not all areas of the state, and it's a supply-demand issue for them. But generally speaking, that's the fastest. The average speed, I believe that we last determined the average speed in the state of Minnesota across everything, is about 2.3 megabits.
So what fraction of that would 200 kilobytes per second be?
A megabit is or 1,000 kilobits is a megabit. So if you took 1,000 of that, you know, it's about a factor of 10,000 there. Here's this is your cocktail talk. So you probably have heard maybe up to gigabyte. So we're talking bytes, not bits here, but same ratios hold. So it's factors of 3. So every designation is 1,000 times the previous one. That's all. So we just talked about this in terms of energy. Sometimes you hear gigawatts, so you get up here. Today, places like Google and YouTube measure the amount of storage they need for the video in terms of either the low end would be petabytes, they're in exabytes. So they're talking that already today. We'll show a chart later that talks about petabytes. In our data centers in Eagan, we have three of them. We have about 8 petabytes of law. So it's not unheard of that you would have this, but this gives you an idea. What this is the untapped amount of information that somebody could say, I want to go look at. So when they say, I need more bandwidth or capability, people are saying, well, there's all this reference material, there's all these videos, there's all these things that I can go do, some of which require higher levels of bandwidth. But this is part of the information explosion. So in a few years, we'll be talking about exabytes regularly. Your computer will probably have terabyte drives in it. You've seen some of them in a portable form already. It'll just keep moving up. The prices will go down. Information will really explode because video is much more consuming than is audio or text. So it's just going to keep multiplying. Here are some of the delivery methods. And to make this simple, kind of boiled it down a bit. So the technologies on the left, the type of technology, some of the methods that are used in that technology, and then a best estimate of the download speeds that are available by that technology. And most of these have footnotes in them. They're not Rick's made-up stuff. They are things that we got out of different documents that people say. There's still different opinions about some of these things, and it depends on whether you happen to compete against or sell certain technologies. You might take a lower or higher number, but take this as a rough comparative estimate. Fiber to the home is not very common. Fiber, you'll hear something called fiber to the node. Fiber to the node means that in your neighborhood somewhere, there's what they call a node. Fiber goes to that point, and from that point to your house is copper. That's more common. And then if you step back from that, fiber along the backbone in a particular area is quite common. So really, if you had fiber to the home, which is expensive, you get very high-speed services. But that's a lot of digging and a lot of work. Cable modems, copper, you get pretty good speeds. And the cable industry has done a lot of good work, as have the phone industry, about maximizing what they can get through a copper line. They keep breaking through with new technologies to get higher speeds. DSL goes along existing phone lines, but they have to be upgraded in the switching station. So right now you see about 20 megabits on the upside, but you can get pretty good broadband in here. You're in the megabit territory. It's very decent service. Wireless is one of those areas that's particularly interesting, I think, in a state that has a lot of rural areas, a lot of lakes, places that you can't necessarily run fiber or even copper to. So when you look at these kinds of solutions up here, there's a lot of hybrids that involve bringing fiber maybe to a certain place and then using existing infrastructure or even wireless. And wireless comes in a couple of forms. There's the standard wireless today that most people use. WiMAX is rolling out. WiMAX needs a lot less a lot less transmitters and receivers. You're about every 5 or 6 miles versus to a mile. So it's technologically a lot easier to put in. And the last one down here, seldom known, is that you can actually do broadband over power lines. And that's something that isn't as strong technologically, but it does get you fairly good speeds. So just over your regular house power line, you can run that. It just runs on a different frequency than your power itself. And the power industry is working on developing that. So these are the delivery methods that we see. And a lot of communities, 2 or 3 of these are paired together to give you the coverage. Now, just to give you an idea about some of the limitations, and I'm not going to go through all these, but if you look at the same ones I just showed you and the speeds, and kind of a look at what happens, what do you need in construction to do these kinds of things? And then does it leverage the infrastructure that exists? And what's the relative cost? a dollar sign doesn't mean a particular number. So fiber to the home, you'd have to have a total fiber network. It would be terrific, of course, and that way doesn't use much of your existing infrastructure because you got to take fiber from the node or wherever it is all the way to each house. Big bucks. Cable modem, the last mile, still coax, upgrading some of them, semi-costly, still not to every area, but, you know, not as expensive as up here. DSL, a little more leverage. Leverage is high because you're using the existing phone lines. You're updating some of the switching centers. Pretty economical way to go. Wireless is going to be moderate to low. It's just got to get places to put the you know, the towers and so forth. And then the broadband over power line represents still something pretty interesting. And the task force actually did some calls with Gartner about this particular technology because we were very interested in, you know, those lines go to every house almost already. You know, how useful would this be and how good would that be? So that may be something that we want to look into a little more. Just to give you an idea, the way the world of content goes here, so the need and the speed, and I'm not saying the need for speed, I'm saying there's a need and the speed. This axis over here, the y-axis, petabytes per month, PB, petabytes, so think back to that chart, and the breakdown over the year, and we've got mobility use, business internet, IP WAN, consumer, and then consumer IPTV or cable TV. And you can see the growth in the consumer internet and the consumer TV portion of these graphs is pretty significant, whereas the part dealing with the business side doesn't show the kind of explosive growth that the consumer side does. So I think the issue that you can see is the growth here is going to be in the consumer side. And if you go back to the earlier chart, it's the consumer side and the small business side that have more of the access issues than do the business sides. Now, it's not true of the small business versus the big as much, but you got that already. So, again, talking about the speed and need, we go back to these some of these pieces and the technology, and I'm just hammering away at trying to get people to think about what kind of speed is required to do certain kinds of applications. And this is always something you can argue about. We just took this one from a source here, but gives you an idea of what's coming out. Streaming video can be done pretty easily for most people today if they have 1 megabit. Otherwise, what happens? Does it not work, or is it just choppy picture? The audio goes off. Video's not quite synced. You end up not watching it. That's what it means by not working. High-resolution testing, standard TV, video conferencing, high-def TV, and almost all of these applications work when you get up to this level. High-def TV, one of the questions that comes up all the time about, like, if you're connected to a cable provider, and let's say you have triple play, or you're connected to a telephone provider and you have triple play. So they're sending you video, they're sending you internet service, they're sending you phone service. They actually can determine for you how much of each one of those they give you for the bandwidth. So high definition TV requires more bandwidth if you use that in that triple play than does standard TV. They have to cut you a bigger piece of the bandwidth pie when you do that. Now, they can either give you as big a piece as you had before, so they take more from the other areas, or you get a bigger total piece. And if you get a bigger total piece, they multiply that all their customers, then they have to upgrade their infrastructure to give you that.
Madam Chair and Mr. King,
Senator Carlson.
When you're talking about the standard TV and high-def TV, are you assuming compression routines in there, too? Or is this something that's uncompressed?
Mr. King.
Senator Carlson, this is the normal compression technique and delivery that they use today. Nothing new is assumed. We just took it off of the data that they report to this source. There are compression techniques mean that you could send a package of information like a video and compress it so that it would actually come to the person using it faster and as a smaller piece, and then it would be basically exploded into its regular size when it gets there. And those techniques are used normally in any of this, but more advanced ones will allow more to be sent over. So what happens here, our providers are chasing how much do they provide and what will people buy based on the application. The application for the consumer is creating the demand, and the supplier sometimes is helping create a demand, and then they're trying to answer the demand and keep it in touch with what people are willing to pay for. Here's a way to look at a regular DVD movie. Now that you know gigabyte, GB is gigabyte versus GP or BPS, which is bits per second. So a regular DVD, not a Blu-ray or anything, is 4.7 gigabytes of storage. That's a regular movie. Okay, so here's a regular movie. If you download a regular movie by these different mechanisms, so this is something you can almost visualize because you probably have thought about doing this or maybe you've done it. The difference in speed is pretty amazing between what these types of downloads do versus even some up here. And what you see now are some emerging business models that are taking advantage of the higher speed. If you've all heard of Netflix, Netflix is a company before that would take a DVD that you order, pop it into a mailer, put it in a truck, the truck drives to the airport, the plane takes off, plane lands at another airport, truck picks up the package, it comes to your house the next day. You can watch the movie. And then you got to send it back. And it goes back first class, but most first class goes on a plane. So think about that truck, plane, back to their place, all to get that movie to the consumer. Bad energy choice, for sure. Not a very good use of the transportation infrastructure either, I wouldn't think, but there you have it. Now, those things can be downloaded, but the problem was they can't be downloaded fast enough for anybody with unlimited patience, who doesn't have that patience. So today, though, with the right service, they actually do allow you to download them. There are actually Blu-ray players that have an interface to Netflix, and you hook your DVD player up to the internet connection that you have, broadband at your house, and you can download those movies that way, and you basically watch them without having any of that transportation infrastructure. You have to take that DVD and fly it around. So they're relying on this whole thing happening to more and more people so that they can shift their business model. And because they're one of the first movers in that whole world, they're able to embed themselves with the DVD players at an early stage and make a game of it. So that's an example of how the increasing bandwidth changes the way businesses look at things and how it also rebalances the infrastructure. If you think about infrastructure as airports, seaports, bike paths, roadways, and the internet. Mm-hmm. And if you send the right things over the right infrastructure, you reduce the peaks of any of the ones. Okay, rankings around the world, a little bit about that. Here's a bunch of statistics that a lot of people like to argue about. And what I do when I put these up, I get a bunch of mail afterward to tell me why it doesn't work. I just say, send me your statistics, and I'll use them. Don't send me why theirs are wrong. This is not the OCSD statistics. These are from an internet provider and user, Alchemy. We're number 6, it says, in unique IPs per capita. So this is basically a measure of internet penetration. IPs are internet protocol. That's a code name for an internet address. Every URL like that you might have, if you have, rick.king or rick king.com is a URL. That has a specific IP address. That IP address is unique on the internet. That's how the whole bunch of computers that are across the internet understand that it is me and nobody else. So every URL has a IP below it. It's interesting which countries are ahead of us. On this chart, we talk about some of the speed. Basically, we're number 8 by speed. This is percent above 5 megabits. We're at 26. Global is 19. That's every country. 58% South Korea, 55% Japan. And then the changes that have occurred. United States, you can see here, plus 0.2, plus 29, plus 0.9. You can see what's happening across the other areas. Some of these areas are geographically denser than the U.S. So you'd think, well, you know, penetration might be better. It might be easier to lay fiber in those kinds of places. Japan's often cited like that. Some of them are certainly not. South Korea, I think Romania. If you look at Sweden, also very dispersed. So it depends. A lot of those countries that have that penetration have a national broadband policy. So they have a direction that they're taking their countries. And here's the states rank. Minnesota, in terms of download speed in the U.S., according to speedmatters.org, 44th. I think some of these are pretty close, so it's definitely in the bottom quarter. And I usually, when I do talks, I usually say we're in the bottom half, just to be generous. So the question sometimes is whether that's where we want to be. And again, if you look up here, there's some there's certainly some density help in Delaware and in Rhode Island, not necessarily in New Jersey because you're dealing with a lot of farmland in the north, but you're not dealing with kind of mountains or lakes. So there's different geographic challenges. But clearly some of them are sparse too.
Senator,
you, Chair. Mr. King, just on that note, is there, and that's for the whole state, so do you know what it would be for just the metropolitan area?
I hope we'll have a better look at that shortly. I do not know. I do not have that broken down yet. The broadband mapping bill that was approved, I think, is going to really help there. Just to, as we start to wrap up, these are some economic impacts that have been done by studies through the U.S. Department of Commerce about the economic impact of having broadband in the area. There's characteristics of job growth rate that is above that which is normed. There are business establishment increases in growth as well. There are higher rents in the zip codes where there's availability. The property values are actually higher. And there's a broader variety of mix of IT-related jobs and some of the higher-paying jobs. This is a very interesting study. I've read it quite a few times, so it's cited down here for you. This is even done with the lower speed definition of what broadband means. So when you think about that, the impact of even it going higher and faster could be more dramatic. So last couple of slides here. In terms of applications, which drives the demand, which the providers then work to provide, to meet, we want to move those carefully and together down the process. But education, culture, and entertainment are key. That's driving a lot of the consumer pieces. Telecommuting, this is where a company like ours is most interested. People say, well, if you buy everything you need, why do you care about this? Why is your company involved in this? And the reason is I want our employees to be able to do the work from home. I want people to not have to commute at the commuter hours. I would like them to be able to use the same applications that we use to power our business from home. In order to do that, they need higher speed connections. They need a connection that's like the connection they have when they're at work, so they can run the same things. That would allow us to take part-time workers at home, stay-at-home moms, someone's sick, they need to take care of a family member, whatever. Those kinds of things are enabled. And sometimes you can just move the transport time by an hour either way, and you can move somebody off the road at the peak and reduce the peak demand on the other part of the infrastructure. Telehealth and telemedicine, I think, is an area where all of the healthcare providers who have come and talked to our task force so far have significant work that they are doing in this area. This area is probably the single biggest area that I think could impact the way we deliver healthcare, but also healthcare costs as well. This will allow us not to put people in cars to go see doctors, but allow doctors local and doctors from important hospitals where they have specialties that might not be resident in our state or in our county to come to the consumer's house via a connection, a telepresence connection over a broadband to be able to talk, diagnose, and look at x-rays and records that involve that and consult with the patient, with the patient's children or parents, as the case may be, at the same time, and the local physician. This is an area that will really help us, in my opinion, one of the strongest areas. I think government services, civic participation, and so forth, and you know all about that. These things are streamed out, and more people can't sleep at night and need to watch these kinds of hearings than ever before. And getting that out there just gives more people an involvement and understanding about what's going on in government. Public safety, homeland security are pretty obvious, and then people with disabilities get that kind of access. This is hard to read on the chart. You've got it in your paper. It's kind of the home of the future. Basically, down here I say the average home today is probably given across the state about 2.3 megabits. And then this talks about different types of services that could be done in the house of the future that might require a home to have much more bandwidth. It's not just having more bandwidth, it's they need to have applications that are real. They need to want to have them, and then they need to get it economically. So that whole equation has to come along together. But it helps connect them to the community, and you can see some of the examples here about TV, about DVDs, about education pieces, and so forth. A bit about the task force. The task force was established in part by this committee and the House, and the governor named some people to it. We're about halfway through our work. We're going to make recommendations to all of you and the governor on November 1st, 2009. Last time I was here, I got a to-do, and the House asked the same thing. If we could provide a list to you of shovel-ready projects for our state, we have a special meeting that we are holding tomorrow to do that. By the end of the month, we'll have a list of possible shovel-ready projects for you to help should the stimulus package come through with broadband money, as it appears to. Looks like this House side bill has $6 billion for broadband in the U.S. The Senate side has a little bit more. The House bill is geared toward, this is the U.S., the House bill is geared toward rural and underserved areas. The Senate bill is geared toward rural, underserved, and there's a piece in the Senate that talks about new technology. What they mean by that is providing demonstrations of services that are 100 megabits or more. So they've got a little bit of the future that they're talking about. Where that comes out in conference, we'll all see. The report will follow what the legislation calls for, but I'll call your attention down here to the URL, the committee proceedings, the minutes, the agendas, all the meetings, hundreds of related pieces of material are all there. So it's a great resource for finding out about broadband. And if any of you are interested in being on the interested party mailing list to get a push on that, just give me your card and I'll drop you on the list. Madam Chair, that's 101.
Well, that was very interesting. Thank you. Are there questions or comments? Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I have a couple, if you don't mind. In the fastest countries, is this universally available at the rate that you're showing on the chart? is that accessible by the entire population or most of it or just a select few?
Mr. King?
Madam Chair and Senator, I would say that what it is accessible to most, if not nearly all. That's the way the statistics are gathered. I always hesitate to say all.
No, I know. And what's ADSL?
That's a higher speed asymmetric digital subscriber line. It's just a newer technology that's using an upgraded version of the DSL line.
And this is an easy one. What's the cost and availability of the different bands?
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, that question I'm going to evade. The cost from a consumer point of view is it varies and is very competitive. People publish it, if that's what you were referring to, Senator. If you mean the cost to actually put it in the ground and install it or run it across lines, then that's a very complicated question that actually involves how far you want to run it, who owns the rights of way, et cetera. So that gets into a whole lot of different issues.
Madam Chair, maybe hard, and you don't Senator have to Van give Huger. It to me now or anything, but hard installation costs, assuming you had the land, is kind of what I was thinking, just a comparison of installing them, unless there is a big difference in how they're installed. But another question was interchangeability. Like if you're going to change out part of a system, is that pretty easy to do or dependent?
Mr. King?
Madam Chair and Senator, if you mean by that, if, let's say, there was copper between certain points and you wanted to upgrade it to fiber, for example, yeah. That would be, if it was buried, you'd have to trench, and then there's electronics on ends, and you'd have to replace that and the line. That's a fairly expensive proposition, not impossible.
Something you probably wouldn't do. I think we have the ultimate carbon reduction plan here, it looks like. But I think that's all I had for now.
Senator, I will comment just on one thing that the committee could consider is that when a trench is open, if you are ever going to put any kind of conduit or cable in, that's the time to do it. The biggest expense in burying cable is not the cable itself or the labor to put the cable in. It's actually the digging part. So a way to look at when trenches are open, city by city or county by county, and take advantage and at least fund a way to put conduit in, because you can put conduit in and put some kind of device to transmit fiber or whatever later. So in terms of making it more cost effective, that's a way to look at it. But the digging part is really quite expensive, and depending on who owns it and who's digging, it's more complex.
Senator Van
Madam Chair, I know you maybe not an expert on installation, but does that mean, like, there isn't a code that when you put this in, if they're laying cable or something, that says that you use conduit, they don't just automatically do that, so you could replace it with, is it an industry norm or?
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's, I don't know for sure. I do know that different people get the rights of way to put their cables into the trenches, and the cities know when the trenches are open, and that some cities are then putting in conduit on their own dime and making it easier for a provider to put in more of the cable or fiber that, you know, that they might need later on.
Would
Senator Vandiver.
Would you think it would be jumping the gun to maybe require that when cities, when those installations go in, make it like part of code or something to use a conduit?
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, Senator, I haven't thought enough about the impact to the businesses that do that kind of work to really comment on that. Conceptually, you know, you'd like to say if it's open, let's take advantage of it. But, you know, I always am careful when I think about putting a code in place to force that, what the downside ramifications might be. And I honestly haven't thought through that.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. King, welcome back. I wanted to kind of follow down this line as where we're going to go with this, and I know it's these different development or ways we could deal with the technology that's available. You said wireless would be the cheapest way to go, and already we're starting to get a lot of our access to the Internet on our phones and things like that. Is it – you see that we're going to be moving to the existing towers that cell phone companies put up as our access point for Internet access, or is it we're going to be competing towers, one for, you know, cell phone use and another one for the Internet into our homes? What do you envision?
Mr. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, I think that first let me say, clarify a bit about the wireless. I guess it would be my opinion that where we can get a fiber cable or a fixed cable run, we're better off with that. But I think when we're in a state like our state and we get to certain areas, it could be that many of the last pieces of the connection to get everybody in the state potentially connected is that we take advantage of the wireless part. It's going to be true, I think, that always one of the fixed cables, if you will, copper or a fiber, is always going to be faster than a wireless. But cost-effectively, wireless is going to be easy to go the last part of the journey for across a lake, across bad terrain, what have you, rather than trying to cable around it. So I think it's the combination of both. I do think that wireless, it's possible that we'll start seeing cell towers, combined with other kinds of wireless. That's not the way we see it today. The communities that are dealing with wireless, they often use the light poles if they own them, or maybe they lease them to put the network access points in for the wireless. What you see today with the current technology, pre-WiMAX, G or N version wireless, is that you need to put so many of those access points in so often that if you don't have the right of way to use the poles, you run into a coverage problem. You're just putting up so many access points, and it's a tough thing to go. With WiMAX capability, the speed and the distance that you can spread those network access points out more like 5 or 6 miles apart starts getting more practical to be able to put those up. Generally, they're going to go on power poles versus a cell tower. Cell towers cover a much larger area than do current wireless or WiMAX type. There's no reason you couldn't put one on there, but you're going to need many more than there are cell towers.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I might, one other question.
Senator
is on
Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The final page there where you're showing this current and future broadband applications and 70 megabytes for bits per second coming into the home. And we're looking at also the development of smart grid technology coming in. Are these two going to be kind of go hand in hand too? Are we going to be sharing lines, or are those going to be separate lines as well as these things develop? What do you see there?
Mr. King?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I think that we're going to see the technology bringing those closer together. I think it's very possible that they could end up sharing the same infrastructure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting presentation, and I appreciate it. Next, I'd like to call on J. Brent Legg and Wes Carr from Connected Nation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the invitation to speak in front of the committee today. Also, if the chair would indulge, I would like to ask Chip Spann, our chief wireless engineer.
Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
I will certainly do so. My name is Brent Legg. I'm the vice president of state and local initiatives for Connected Nation. Our subsidiary 501c3 nonprofit, Connect Minnesota, produced a broadband availability map for the state, and that's what we're going to be discussing today.
Okay.
Wes?
My name is Wes Kerr, and I just want to thank you for the time to be here today.
Okay.
My name is Chip Spann. I'm the Senior Network Engineer and Wireless Business Analyst for Connected Nation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just by way of introduction, those of you who are not familiar with Connected Nation as an organization, we are a national nonprofit 501c3 organization. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we facilitate market-based strategies for doing two things, expanding broadband availability and increasing broadband adoption rates across the U.S. Through public-private partnerships. We believe that, and this is part of our mission statement, we believe that states, communities, families, and individuals can realize great economic and social advantages when we accelerate broadband availability in unserved areas and when we increase broadband use in all areas, rural and urban. There are five, you may hear reference to the Connected Nation model. It's certainly something that we have tried to educate folks about in D.C., and it consists of these five components. Broadband mapping is the first of those five components. You may have heard of our initiative called Connect Kentucky. We have implemented all five of these model components in that state, as well as with Connected Tennessee and our Connect Ohio initiatives. We are currently working in a number of states. I mentioned Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio. We have also produced broadband availability maps for the states of West Virginia and South Carolina. Minnesota is the sixth state. We're currently working on broadband maps in North Carolina and Colorado. And we have RFPs pending to do this work in Kansas, Texas, and Illinois. So we're working in a number of states across the country. Just by way of background, and most of you are probably familiar with how we got to this point of producing a broadband map for the state of Minnesota, an omnibus bill, the omnibus finance bill, containing language to create a statewide broadband inventory mapping project was included in Senate File 3337, which passed the legislature on May 7th of last year and was signed into law by Governor Pawlenty on May 12th. The Minnesota Department of Commerce was charged with issuing an RFP for qualifying vendors. Connect Minnesota, our 501c3 subsidiary, submitted a bid and was subsequently selected by the Department of Commerce to develop the map for the state. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, Connected Nation brings years of experience to the Connect Minnesota program and having worked with broadband providers in a number of states to produce these maps. Connected Nation has mapped broadband on a scale much, much larger than anyone else in the United States. Some key points about the maps that we produced for the state. Provider participation in the mapping process was and remains voluntary. 98 broadband providers from across the state of Minnesota have participated in the map to date. And it's very important for us to mention that the maps are currently in a preliminary state. And new information is being added daily. The Minnesota Department of Commerce, our contract with them, they asked us to release a preliminary set of maps by February 1st of 2009. Those went on live on our website on February 1st, which is www.connectmn.org. And a final set of maps is to be completed by June 30th of this year. During the next 4.5 months, Connect Minnesota will be continuing the process of field personnel validating the data across the state. We're going to be seeking input from the public sector, from the provider community, and from state leaders to identify any inaccuracies and suggest revisions to the map. And we are already receiving that feedback and making adjustments. There's actually a couple of different forms on our website that users can fill out if they notice indication of broadband availability. We also aggregate demand for broadband via the website. So if a user is not able to receive broadband access, they can use their dial-up connection or use their work internet connection to go on our website and tell us that they want broadband and would subscribe if it were made available to them. We are also continuing to gather data from providers that aren't currently represented on the map. We have had great participation from the provider community. Typically, it takes Connected Nation approximately 6 months to get the first version of a map completed. Our contract with the Department of Commerce was signed in early October, and so we've actually turned this map around in a much shorter time frame. And I will say, if you promise not to tell other states that we're doing this mapping process in, that this is the most accurate map we've ever produced for a state. Some key findings. We have received data from cable companies, municipalities, wireless internet service providers, rural co-ops, ILEX and CLEX that operate a variety of broadband platforms from DSL to cable to fixed wireless to mobile wireless and fiber service. Out of all of that information, and I think my colleague Chip distributed a copy of the map to you, approximately 92% of Minnesota households have access to some form of broadband, meeting that speed definition that Mr. King discussed earlier. The remaining 8% comprises approximately 151,000 Minnesota households, or about 418,000 people, that do not have access. We expect household availability to increase by about 2% as other providers are added to the map. But consumer validation of the map could also negatively impact that number as well. So it may end up being a wash, but we'll wait to see over the next 4.5 months as we continue compiling the data. This is an example of a platform-neutral broadband map, and the colors are showing up pretty accurately on the screen there. The areas of pink, both light pink and dark pink, are indicative of where some form of landline broadband service is available. And then there's an area of light blue that shows where mobile wireless broadband service is available. And then if you compare that to the map that you have in your hand, which actually breaks the service platforms down by individual type, from fiber to cable to DSL to wireless, fixed wireless, and then mobile wireless, you see that there are a number of different types of broadband being provided around the state. This again, there are 98 broadband providers represented on this map. And our mapping team is adding data actually today, in addition to what's reflected here. These maps are also available in an interactive form on our website, www.connectmn.org. It's actually address searchable, so you could go in and type your street address in, zoom into your local street, and be able to determine what broadband providers are providing service at your address. Of course, this is a tool that we're also going to be using to verify the accuracy of the map over time. We believe it's highly accurate as it stands now, but there will be tweaks that need to be made along the way. And as you can imagine, when you're mapping a state the size of Minnesota and taking in the amount of data that we took in to produce this map, there are going to be tweaks that need to be made over time. And that's why we started with this preliminary mapping process, so we would have the ability to refine the maps over time. You can add and remove layers. You can there are lots of different tools. There are links to the providers that are providing service. So someone could theoretically go to a website and subscribe, sign up for service. We also produced a series of speed maps, and we did this, and I can go into detail if the committee is interested in how exactly we are able to track actual speeds. We found that the average download speed statewide, and this is including the Twin Cities, is higher than we've seen in any other state that we've mapped so far, and that's at approximately 6.5 megabits per second. The average upload speed, that's the download speed, the first one I mentioned. The average upload speed is approximately 1.5 megabits per second. This speed data was obtained through a company called Ookla NetMetrics, and they have testing servers in the Twin Cities area, as well as Grand Forks, North Dakota, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Those are the testing servers that are nearest to here. And users performed these tests on such sites as speedtest.net. Ookla NetMetrics operates speedtest.net as well as a variety of other speed testing websites around the internet. You heard Rick mention earlier a reference to speedmatters.org, which is ran by the Communication Workers of America. They're partners of ours, and a lot of companies and organizations like CWA use Ookla NetMetrics to measure actual upload and download speeds that users are experiencing. The sample size is comprised of approximately 200,000 tests that have been performed since November of 2008, so this is very recent data. Connect Minnesota's own speed testing tool on our connectminnesota.org site has performed approximately 2,000 tests to date, thanks to advertisement on in the blogosphere about the availability of the speed testing tool. But we have excluded that data from our speed maps, and there were concerns raised over the last couple of weeks about our testing server's physical location and its limited throughput capacity. Minnesota's in a unique situation because you have a consumer-grade broadband service that's available at higher bandwidths here that we just haven't experienced in the other states in which we've mapped. And so we had to make adjustments to our speed testing tool to allow the test to perform accurately over a network such as Comcast that's available at up to 50 megs service here in the Twin Cities. And so we are... we actually, during the past week, we have relocated our testing server to Chicago and added the ability to measure a symmetrical 100 megabit per second connection on that server. So we have a dedicated server that's directly connected to a network that's on the internet backbone, and we can measure speeds such as Comcast's cable service here in the Twin Cities much more accurately than we were able to. So we're going to be collecting that data once again via connectmn.org. We're urging people that are associated with the Broadband Task Force and others to encourage people to test their connections. That will increase the validity of our data and provide for much more reliable speed maps as we move toward our final mapping date. This is an example of the speed map that we've produced using that 200,000 test sample from Ookla.net Metrics that was collected independently of this initiative, but they've through a partnership with us, they share that data that they test. So if you've ever been on speedtest.net and you ran a connection from your ran a test from your home connection, that that sample is probably included in this 200,000 sample that we have from Ookla.net Metrics. As you can see, the darker areas on the screen here are areas of the state where higher download speeds are being experienced by consumers. The yellowish areas and the light green areas are areas where download speeds are far less than that. We were asked at an earlier meeting today if it would be possible to extract the Twin Cities out from that statewide average that I mentioned and see what the average statewide download speed would be. We can certainly do that. And we produced a similar map, too, that shows the average upload speed. And as you can see, as you get outside of the Twin Cities area, the average upload speed is significantly less. Again, I want to emphasize that we've had great participation from the providers here in the state. The providers have provided us more granular data here than we've experienced in any other place. Companies like Quest and Comcast and others down to the local co-op should be commended for providing us with such great data to produce this map. We're very proud of it, and we know that it's going to be evolving over the next 4 months. So we believe that it is highly accurate as it stands now. It can be used as a tool for helping the Broadband Task Force make decisions about where shovel-ready projects could potentially be. But knowing that data is being added to the map all the time, I think the providers that are not currently reflected on the map will have a very good reason to add their data to the map as we go throughout this this next process, these next few months. So I want to pause and take any questions that you might have regarding the map. And certainly this doesn't have to be the only time you can ask questions. You can call us directly. Our contact information is on the website, too. So,
question?
Madam Chair.
Do you expect that you have a period now of... input or feedback, do you expect that the map will be changing very much during that period of time?
We believe that up to 2% of households could be potentially covered by the data that we're still waiting to come in. At the same time, we think that that around 2% of the data could be questioned in terms of accuracy, tweaks that need to be made over time, so it may be a wash. We just don't know until we go through this process of receiving inquiries. The maps have only been posted on the website since this past Sunday, so we're receiving broadband inquiries every day and checking into those as we go. We'll have people on the ground field validating. Mr. Chip Spann, my colleague, has spent an extraordinary amount of time on the ground here in Minnesota all over the state, experiencing temperatures below, well below zero. negative 47, I believe, was one.
We've had one
daytime
of our
high.
Colder winters.
Yeah, indeed. So we're going to be spending more time on the ground testing the validity of the map, making sure that it is ultimately an accurate tool at the end of the day.
And you mentioned that about 92% of households in Minnesota have access to broadband.
That's
Do you
right.
have any way of knowing how many actually access broadband?
That is something that we do in other states. We measure that in terms of adoption, broadband adoption. And I can back up to the different components of our work. That involves an extensive amount of survey research. Here we go. And we have not been asked to do that as part of our contract with the state. There is the potential, if the stimulus bill passes the U.S. Congress, as we think it will, there is money included in the stimulus bill to fund Senate Bill 1492, which passed Congress last year, which is the Broadband Data Improvement Act. And it essentially provides federal grants up to 80% of the cost of an initiative to launch an initiative just like what we have launched in Kentucky and Tennessee and Ohio. So that would provide some much-needed federal funds to do all five components of the Connected Nation model, not just mapping.
And at 92% access, how does that compare nationwide?
Well, it's right on target. It's right on par with what we saw in our a map that we produced for the state of Ohio. It is, and I can let one of my colleagues address Tennessee. Where are we currently in Tennessee?
The state of Tennessee is also nearing that, or is right at that 90% mark.
Yeah, so that's a little bit about above average. The state that we've seen that has the greatest extent of broadband coverage is actually South Carolina, believe it or not. They sit at about 96%, yeah, household availability. And that's including mobile wireless broadband. If that is factored out of the equation, I think it's about 90, it's right at about 92%. So South Carolina is doing a bit better, but Minnesota is still doing quite well, and it is in terms of speed testing the highest return for average speed across the state at 6.5 megs is higher than we've seen in other states. But obviously, we do want to factor out the Twin Cities in that equation and see if that has a significant impact on the average speed statewide.
How about do you judge the adequacy of that broadband throughout the state?
We're leaving that to the broadband task force to do. We were asked to do this work, this very specific work. Broadband connections are constantly evolving, and the need for speed, as Rick mentioned, is constantly evolving. And so it is sort of a moving target. But we really withhold judgment from that and let policymakers decide what's adequate. We just want to identify what is available. That's part of our objective in this project.
In our basic infrastructure, is there the capability of increasing capacity?
Certainly in some areas. If fiber has been placed in the ground or elsewhere, there's the capability to expand that service. It just really depends on the type of technology that's been deployed.
So it looks from this that we really have limited fiber, though, right?
I would say that's true. I would let Chip address that question in terms of fiber availability.
Okay. Mr. Spann?
Madam Chairman? As far as I know, from the information that we've received so far, you have an overwhelmingly large amount of cable modem and DSL, which would be obvious. And this state has been unique that you have an exceptionally large amount of wireless coverage from the telephone cooperatives using the 700 megahertz band and a number of independent wireless ISPs using unlicensed spectrum. The amount of fiber that we've identified on this map has been perhaps smaller than we estimated we would see in the state?
Well, and I think it's important.
Mr. Kerr?
I'm sorry. It's important to note that, as compared with the other states that we have participated in this process with, the state of Minnesota actually has more fiber in the ground and has more companies who have made that investment at this point than we have seen in other states. as to gauge, you know, as to the, you know, the overall amount of fiber, I really couldn't respond to that, but it's, there is more here than we have encountered in other locations.
Yeah, I'm surprised at all the fiber in the more rural areas as opposed to the urban areas of the state.
Right. Well, the rural telcos have been, some have been very aggressive in deploying fiber, and the difficulty, and I definitely encourage each of the members of the committee to check out the interactive website so that you can see the different types of providers that are here in the Twin Cities. Naturally, when you're producing a map like what we distributed to you, there are different layers there that are hidden. So obviously here in the Twin Cities you have DSL. I'm sure there's a fiber network here, or there may be a fiber network here in the Twin Cities. I'm not sure, but there are different types of broadband service that is provided here. And the difficulty in a static map like you have in front of you is that it naturally gives preference to one type of service over another, and so that's why we encourage people to go to the interactive website where you can add and remove layers and you can identify the broadband providers that way. Mr. Spann?
Madam Chairman, I'd also like to point out that the purpose of this map was to identify where there was broadband availability, and therefore we did not set out to illustrate where dark fiber existed in the state. So our feeling is that there is quite a bit more fiber available that has not yet been activated for use for distribution.
Okay. Senator Dibble, did you have questions?
I was curious about the discrepancy. Maybe it's a median versus average in the report that we had from Mr. King, the median download speed and the ranking as contrasted with the report. Do we know why we have the discrepancy, or maybe we should get you guys to talk to each other?
Mr. Lake.
Madam Chair, Senator, it would be difficult for me to give a good answer to that question without knowing the sample size of the data that was used for that other comparison. It may be that the data actually is very similar if the Twin Cities is extracted from that figure, because obviously higher speeds are deployed here. Comcast has the 50 meg service deployed here in the Twin Cities. So it may be that may be having some effect on the data. That's why we tried to show a geographic distribution of speeds on this map. So you can see that the speed range in areas outside the Twin Cities is quite different than what you see here on average. That may have something to do with it. The sample size that we used was very recent data. It was from November 2008 through just last week. So, and it was 200,000 tests. So all of those factors could have an effect on that result. And speeds are certainly ticking up. I mean, we're seeing this in all of the states in which we're working. So if the data was somewhat old that Mr. King cited, it could be that the speed has ticked up since that study was conducted.
It's very disparate.
Okay.
We have ranking at 44 and 1.5 for median download speed. It's contrasted with 6.6, I think you said.
6.5 is about what the average is statewide.
All right.
Yep.
Okay. I'm assuming Mr. King's work group will be able to make use of some of this data as they move
absolutely.
Forward.
Madam Chair, absolutely. And we are meeting with the ultra high speed broadband task force tomorrow, and providing the same presentation to the members of that task force. I'm sure that it will involve some fairly in-depth questions about the study, how it was produced, and how we arrived at these results. We want this to be a tool for them to use, and we want to work with them to make it as accurate as possible over the next few months. And we think we're going to get there. We think it's highly accurate as it stands today, but as more and more providers provide their data, and I think they will be very much encouraged to do that now that there's such a map in existence, they don't want to be left out, the product at the end of June will be quite good.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you very much. Members of the committee, thank you.
And well, that brings us to the end of our meeting. We'll be meeting again on Tuesday, February 10th, and at that time we have some bills that we will be taking up. Meeting adjourned.